you probably had a closet full of uniforms. Mm-hmm. And these uniforms were for every after school and sports program that you participated in. And you did the fall in this, and the winter in this, and the spring in that, and maybe you continued a second year, maybe you tried something new the second year, and you constantly had these uniforms because you kept trying things until something would stick. Mm-hmm. But we don't do that as adults.
Yeah.
We don't give ourselves the opportunity to try things. And we sort of get molded into this one area that you started in, and you just continue down that path, even though it might not be serving you anymore, and you might not be interested in it anymore, and you might not even like it anymore. Mm. But you're so good at it,
yeah.
You can't imagine doing anything else, which is why I really say that just because you're good at something doesn't mean that you are intrinsically motivated to do it.
Welcome to Partnership Plus, your go-to source for modern partnership wisdom with your host, Phil Hayes Sinclair.
Ruth Gottian.
Yes.
It is a real pleasure to meet you. I have been a fan of your work and your book, Success Factor. I'm keen to dive into so many aspects of this, and we'll find the intersection for partnerships as well. But let's start with the mission you're on.
Yeah.
What is it that you are trying to bring right through the population of the world in terms of leadership and mentoring?
What am I trying to do? Well, you know, I think we've been subconsciously being told to aim for average. But I don't think anyone really wants to be average. I really think that people want to be successful, and they want to improve and want to be the best they can be. The problem is we've never been taught how to do that. Mm-hmm. And it's never really been studied in the scientific way. So I was able to do that. I was able to talk to these extreme high achievers, the astronauts and the Nobel Prize winners and Olympians and NBA champions, figure out what made them so successful and how the rest of us mere mortals can improve our own success based on that blueprint.
So there are four attributes that you have talked about in your book, which I think make a lot of sense. When people will read those, they will go, yes, I think I understand what they mean conceptually.
Yeah.
But I don't think I've ever been shown what that means. And I don't think I know how to internalize that, because I might not have a role model. I may not have access to the mentoring.
Yeah.
I actually might not have access to the encouragement to know which direction to take.
Yeah.
So let's walk through those four attributes and tell me, how did that dawn? How did the research sort of bring that to life? Because the people you were talking to in this research were extraordinary people in their own right. How did that surface itself to give you those four?
So I'm a social scientist, which means I talk to people a lot, but it's talking in a very, very structured way without them realizing that it's a structured way. And then there's actually a process that we do behind the scenes where we transcribe the transcripts, right? This was long before Zoom and Fathom and all that did that. And then we code them in a very, very precise way. And when you start to code them, these themes start to emerge. Mm. And once I realized that the Nobel Prize winner was just like the astronaut, who was just like the Olympian, that's when I realized that success can be learned. But again, we've never been taught how to do it. So You're right. You know, we're told what to do all the time. That's not a problem. Mm. You can Google that. You can go on YouTube, whatever. But being told what to do and being told how to do it are two completely different things.
So true.
And that's so when true. I realized there was really a gap. So, for example, one of the first element is to tap into your intrinsic motivation. That's what comes from within, right? That's the reason you were put on this earth, the reason you can't wait to get out of bed to start working on it, the reason you can't quiet your mind at night. It's not for the awards, rewards, bonuses, promotions. That's extrinsic motivation. And when you do extrinsic motivation, that's really hard to maintain because that's when other people are judging you. Mm. But when you're doing it for yourself, that motivation comes from within. So great, I told you that you need to tap into your intrinsic motivation. The question is how? How do you do it, right? So that's one of the things in the book, The Success Factor, is I teach people how to tap into their intrinsic motivation. And anyone who's listening, you can do that first step now. It's with something that I call a passion audit, which is a 3-column exercise that I put together in order to really, it asks you these questions to get you to think about what it is that you really enjoy doing versus what you're good at. Those are not the same things.
So if
your listeners really want to tap into that and start doing that passion audit, they can just go on my website, ruthgotian.com/passion audit. But I want to tell you one thing. The passion audit, you should be doing that every time you have a transition in your life. A new job, a new partner, a new child, a new home, a pandemic. Because what we have learned and we have seen amplified during the COVID pandemic is that when we have these transitions in our lives, our focus and our passions change. We are not the same at 40 that we were at 20. Our passions have changed, so we need to pivot with that. And that's why the passion audit is such an incredible tool.
That's super fascinating because I often wonder if there is a time in someone's life before they've reached your work, whether they're able to see a glimpse into themselves to understand if they have a handle on what that intrinsic motivation actually might be. Because the people that you see who have got a very strong grasp of that often seem to be leading their best life, right? They're very well in tune with what's going on. There are obviously three other factors we'll get to, but the foundation, the base for what they're doing and why they're doing it is very, very clear to them. And it feels like it's almost a point of envy for others. How did you get to that thing? Because I want that thing.
Yes.
So I'm just curious, you know, taking the audit between all those different points, I get that. Is there an average time or age where you found that some, like these people have gone, you know what, I think I realized this when I was 33 or I was 12 or I hit 60 and I finally got it. Like, is there some sort of commonality around that or not?
You're talking to someone who went back to school at 43 to study this. So look, I don't believe in putting age limits or caps on things, but let's take a look back at our childhood because I think there's a lesson to be learned there. How often, anyone who's listening who has children or they go back to their youth, they might remember that you probably had a closet full of uniforms. Mm-hmm. And these uniforms were for every after school and sports program that you participated in. And you did the fall in this and the winter in this and the spring in that. And maybe you continued a second year. Maybe you tried something new the second year. And you constantly had these uniforms because you kept trying things until something would stick.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't do that as adults.
Yeah.
We don't give ourselves the opportunity to try things. And we sort of get molded into this one area that you started in and you just continue down that path, even though it might not be serving you anymore and you might not be interested in it anymore and you might not even like it anymore.
Mm.
But you're so good at it,
yeah.
You can't imagine doing anything else. Which is why I really say that just because you're good at something doesn't mean that you are intrinsically motivated to do it.
Yeah.
Big difference.
It's a massive difference. All right. So that's attribute number one.
Yes.
Attribute number two.
So number two, you've heard about grit and resilience and a strong work ethic, and that's all true. 100% you need that. But that's not a goal. That's a baseline.
Yeah.
The difference is really how you pursue challenges. So the high achievers have a very distinct focus. For them, it's not a question of if they will overcome the challenge. The question is how. Mm. And they ask themselves, what is the strategy I haven't thought of yet? And I'll give you a perfect example. One of the people who I interviewed was a biochemist by the name of Dr. Peggy Whitson. She worked at NASA as a biochemist. Not everyone who works at NASA is an astronaut. Most people don't know that. But she wanted to be an astronaut. That was her goal. And she applied and was rejected. And she applied again and was rejected. And applied again and was rejected. Now, this kept happening over and over and over again for 10 years. Most people I know would not apply for the same job for a decade. Yep. But I asked her, I said, Peggy, why did you apply for the same job over and over again? She said the question was not if I was going to become an astronaut.
Yeah.
The question was how.
Mm.
What is the gap between what they're looking for and what I've shown them? And how can I work to fill that gap?
Mm.
And once she figured that out, she started to close the gap. And you know what happened? She got accepted. She became an astronaut, but that's not all. She spent more days in space than any American astronaut. She became the first female commander of the International Space Station, a role she held twice. And ultimately, she went on to become NASA's chief astronaut. Imagine if she would have quit after that first rejection.
So much about that speaks to me. And look, on a personal note, I'm former Army, and As an infantry soldier, my ambition was to fly. I applied. There were only three times you could apply. And on the third time, I made it.
Yay.
But it was one of those things that the first time, because I'm almost 6 foot five, very difficult to tell on this screen, obviously. And when we were going through this process, I thought height was the problem. But that was not the problem. It was other skills and attributes. And so I just worked as hard as possible to get there. And I was completely surprised when they said, congratulations. I thought that was never going to happen. So I hear you completely on that attribute.
Love it. Love it.
All right. Attribute number three. And we're going through this because there is an approach that I want to sort of talk with you about how this plays into then how people collaborate and then partner, because there is a natural magnetism, it feels to me, when people hold these attributes and they practice them, that people want to be around them. They want to do things together and create new things together.
Yes.
And it's so easy to collaborate with these people when you get to that point.
Yes.
If you're one of those people. But there's an ambition, I think, for others to want to try and be like that. But they're sort of struggling to work out if they're worthy is the wrong way to say it, but sort of have all the things that they need to sort of partner properly. So attribute number three.
Number three is having that super strong foundation where you're never resting on your laurels. In fact, you strengthen that foundation each and every day.
Mm.
So an example, one of the people who I interviewed for your American listeners was Bonnie Blair. Bonnie Blair was a long track speed skater. Now, at that time when she was competing in the Winter Olympics, her main competitors were what were then the East Germans. Now, you know, they all go in the Olympic Village to the gym together, and she saw their thighs and she said, Ruth, they were like tree trunks. She said, I was never going to have their power. And she said, I didn't have the power, but I was going to beat them on skill. And she went back to her original long track speed skating coach to refine and perfect those skills and did them over and over and over again, even though they were already embedded in her muscle memory.
Mm.
Make it better, make it better, make it better, make it better. Ultimately, she beat the East Germans and she won and became an Olympic champion.
Yeah. It is in the small areas where I think people can see a focus and see a path through that there is huge leveling up that they can do to make that work. And there is no doubt about that. And I think it's in the small, boring things that might otherwise pass you by.
100%.
Right? Super fascinating. All right. Attribute number four.
Number four. Now, this one is the one that surprised me the most.
Okay.
Now, you heard of Mark Cuban, mm-hmm. Bill Gates, Warren Buffett. They all notoriously are known to read 3 to 8 hours a day. They read anything they can get their hands on. But it's not reading that made them billionaires. It's opening their mind up to new knowledge. And then starting to make connections between two points that other people don't yet see.
Yeah.
So while they're reading 3 to 8 hours a day, that is, because I said that's not what made them billionaires, we can also start doing that by opening our minds up to new ideas. So what are ways to do that? Sure, you can read books, you can read articles, you can watch webinars, you can take LinkedIn learning courses. I have a bunch on there that people watch. You can listen to podcasts. You can also have conversations with people. And that's where mentorship plays such a strong role. All of these high achievers surrounded themselves with a team of mentors. And that's why that led to my latest book, Financial Times Guide to Mentoring. Mm-hmm. So that's something to keep in mind. It's not the reading 3 to 8 hours a day. That is not for everyone. If you work full time and have a commute and have little kids, you're not reading 3 hours a day, right?
Nope.
But there are other ways that you can open your mind up to new knowledge, for sure.
Let's double click on that idea of a team of mentors, because I have a team of mentors, and I feel like it's quite a normal thing to do. People often think of it in a singular format. I have a mentor.
Yes.
And many don't have a mentor. They may have it. It may be looking at them right in the face, and they've got a different language for it.
That's right.
What are your thoughts on this idea of mentors who are a very diverse, eclectic group? Like if we think about a healthcare team, for example. Often if you go to emergency, there is a team of people that are surrounding you to try and work out how to get you back out the door again. And they're all very different in what they, in the skills they bring.
That's right.
My mentoring team includes men who are older than I am, women who are younger than I am, and the opposite is true. Mm-hmm. And they all provide vastly different points of view. And I value it deeply. It's one of my go-tos. How should people who don't really think they've got a mentor right now, but do have in the back of their mind, I should really get a mentor.
Yeah.
What are they looking for in that to try and take that first step if they have zero mentoring mentee experience and are trying to sort that out?
If they're trying to find one?
Right.
Well, first, let's talk about why they don't have one.
Mm.
Right? So we all know that those who have mentors out-earn and outperform those who don't. There's a lot of research on this. 76% of the people understand the benefits of having a mentor. And if you don't, let me know. I could talk about that all day and all night. You are going to get promoted more often. You're going to make more money. You're going to have lower burnout. You're going to be happier in your job, happier in your career, greater loyalty, greater retention, all of that. But only 37% of people actually have a mentor. And if you think about why, they're always looking for the perfect person.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I need somebody who mirrors my ambition, who is the same gender or race or ethnicity or industry or religion. Or that person doesn't exist.
Right.
And even if they did exist, you're actually doing yourself a disservice if you pick that person. Because you will then be in an echo chamber, only hearing about things in one way. It's also a disservice to that mentor, especially if they're from an underrepresented group, because there are not that many of them in senior roles. They can't spend all of their time mentoring. The more contemporary approach is, as you said, a mentoring team. This is a diverse group. Sure, you want people who are as close to you as possible in terms of your gender, race, religion, whatever it is, because they can empathize with some of the things that you're going through.
Right.
Absolutely. But they should not be your only mentor. You want people who are senior to you, at your level, junior to you, within your industry, outside of your industry. This is how you start developing a mentoring team. And like you, my mentoring team is extremely diverse. It is physicians and scientists and educators, lawyers, military, finance. Because this is how, if I have a challenge, I approach the right person who could probably give me the best guidance. this is not a board meeting, even though they're often called a board of advisors. I don't need to get them on a Zoom call or in a conference room. They don't even know of each other's existence.
That's it.
I just reach out to the right people. And if any of the listeners want to start developing their own mentoring team, I want to give them a tool that's been used by thousands of people all over the world that really helps you develop a layered mentoring team.
Fantastic.
Just go. It's right there on my website. They can download it for free. Ruth Gotian, G-O-T-I-A-N, ruthgotian.com/mentoring team.
And we'll link to that in the show notes too. I'm going to check that out right after this, because I think there is, there have been different times throughout my career where that team has needed to change, as is the case most of the time, right?
Yes.
And there are some fantastic organizations here in Australia that support mentor development. And in the States, I know there are as well. So we'll add some more notes to that. Ruth, when we think about how different people operating in different industries apply these attributes, also think about mentoring, the power of mentoring. I'm just curious what you see the differences to be. In science and medicine, it's a very different community, say, for example, from finance. There are, of course, some attributes that go between both, which are common. But when you think about the way that doctors and scientists in particular have to do that, and I ask this question as a scientist, as someone who's trained as a scientist myself, I'm curious how that plays, because for the most part, you know, science and the way that science is done is a language and is a culture, and it's one that is rarely done outside of those disciplines. So I'm just wondering, how does mentoring and the development, the application of those attributes play for those folks when compared to other industries based on your research?
I promise to all the listeners, I did not ask you to ask me this question.
You absolutely did not.
So an example I often give is one within healthcare. All right, so it's adjacent to the science. Hmm. There was an issue in operating rooms of medical errors. And the doctors kept trying to find solutions to these medical errors. Do you know where the solution was found?
I do not.
The aviation industry. They now use, anyone who's ever had an operation anywhere in the world will know that there's a timeout, there's a pause, and there's a checklist that the doctors go through. The idea for that checklist came from aviation. That's what pilots use.
Oh, indeed. Many
right?
checklists.
And you
many,
know
many
that.
Checklists.
Many, many checklists. So a problem in one industry can be solved with a solution from another industry. Hmm. You don't need to know about the mechanics of the operating room or of the aircraft. You need to understand and speak in more abstract terms about problem solution and see where that overlap occurs.
Right.
Everyone thinks that, oh, we're so different. We're unique.
Unique, yep.
Not that unique. Not that unique at all. And there are solutions in other industries, which is why you need to cross over into other industries.
When you think about trust as an element to forge progress, to what extent did your research surface the idea that trust plays a really critical role in progress amongst those really high achievers?
Yeah. Look, they surround themselves with a team. All of these people, they start at it alone. And that's how they get out of the starting blocks. But to go far, you need to have a team around you. And you need to trust those people that they want what is best for you. And one of the way that's translated is into the feedback that they're given. So if you look at high achievers, they crave feedback because feedback makes them better. But if they didn't trust these people, they would put on a coat of armor and start defending their actions.
Yeah.
But because they trust these people, they say, give me more, because the feedback is not a critique, it's ideas. It's ideas of how to make things better. And that's how we need to start looking at that. Trust is at the core of all of it.
It's interesting, in the military, and as you know, you know, we spend a lot of time in after action reviews.
Yes.
We spend a lot of time in the debrief process, and really, for anyone who's come into that without having had the culture surrounding them to make that work, it's a confronting experience. But of course, there are a couple of things that make that work, and one of them is a rankless environment. The other one is the ability to have very clear observations, which are about the circumstance, not about the person. And there is a training, I think, that people have to go through to sort of shed any kind of, personal vindication that yes. they're waiting to sort of absorb themselves. This is clear in the military. It does happen in other industries as well. If we were to try and cultivate that culture so that organizations could work more effectively, how would you suggest they go down that track?
Yes, and you know, it's interesting, the after action reviews are in the military for any country.
Correct, exactly.
Every
it's a very common factor.
Every yep. uses that, right? And in healthcare, mm-hmm. they use the same thing as well. It's really about learning, and are you a learning organization? Or are you a know-it-all organization? Mm. If you are a learning organization, every past experience builds something new in your learning. So we talk about experiential learning as learning by doing, mm-hmm. but I would say there's also learning from doing.
Yeah.
And that is where you have the ability to have all these other people hold up a mirror to each other, wipe out the ranks, the titles, the hierarchy, and what can we learn? Because sometimes the boots on the ground people, they see a lot and know a lot more.
So true. Oh my goodness. I mean, the number of times that I've built partnerships, both in the military and outside, where my first go-to, and it's been this case, it must be because I enlisted and I've been on that front line. I will forever create a beeline to the front line in any circumstance to understand what's going on. It is almost my first port of call. And some people call it mystery shopping. But, you know, when I first get to any kind of coaching engagement, my first thing is to call the company, is to sort of see what's going on.
Yeah.
And people often wonder, why would you like to go and see the people? Aren't we here to coach this particular part of the organization? And we get, yes, you are, but I'm going to learn an order of magnitude more from the next hour of seeing this front line than I will walking around this organization for 6 months.
So true. I do a lot of executive coaching with elite athletes, and I see that all the time. It's not just about who you are. It's how you're working with other people. That tells me a lot. I could watch you in one practice and learn a hell of a lot.
Mm-hmm. I hear you.
Without saying a word.
When we think about the overlooked factors, the things that make it really interesting and quick to build that trust, build the relationship, and make progress together, and this is in the context of business partnerships, what do you think is the most, or some of the most overlooked factors that people aren't seeing? And I ask that because when people go, and leaders go into deals and they forge a partnership, they write the press release, they get that into market, and everyone feels very happy about what's going on, and then 8 months later it's sort of dead on arrival because actually no one knew what was going on. What are the factors, do you think, that we're missing in that process?
Yeah, I think that listening tour is one of the most pivotal foundational steps that most people skip.
Mm.
And the listening tour has to be with every stakeholder, not just those in the boardroom, but also those who are answering the phones and opening the mail.
Right.
Because they see things, they hear things, they're actually using whatever it is that we are building. And we need to know what works for them, what doesn't work for them, what they like, what they don't like, what they want changed, what they don't want changed. And I don't think those conversations are happening.
Mm.
And that's change management 101.
Yeah, I agree. I think, there are probably two main factors that we look for when we walk into an organization. It can be a business or another type of organization. One of them is this clear shared language and this intention that is rock solid. And many people will say to me, oh no, we've had many meetings where we're on the same page. I said, show me the page.
Yeah.
And
what is that page?
What is that page? And the page that I'm actually referring to is a 5-slide deck that we create, which we call an intention deck. And it's basically saying, why does this make sense? Why are we here? And what are the principles we're going to operate under when the going gets tough? And without that, it's very difficult to make any of that work. When you talk about the idea of listening, it's fascinating how the light bulbs come on in people's eyes when they've been able to realize that actually that was not a difficult exercise. And now I actually feel quite clear about this. I don't have to worry about this anymore. Yeah. We've got a path. We can keep moving down it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What's a partnership that you've come across that sits in your mind as an exemplar?
So I think, you know, it's interesting. My last book, Financial Times Guide to Mentoring, I had a co-author, Andy Lapata. Mm-hmm. And I had been working in mentoring for years. He had been working in mentoring for years. And we approached this book and he said to me, you know, it's not about you writing half and me writing half. I was like, yeah, I know. He said, because most people think partnership is we just split the workload in half, but that's not how it works.
Nope.
What makes partnerships work so well is that if the final product is better than what either person could have done alone, because they bring something, another perspective that was not in your orbit. And that's why I think the Financial Times Guide to Mentoring is doing so well as a book, because it brings my best traits and Andy Lapata's best traits and melds them together to create something brand new that neither one of us could have done alone. So I think that is a personal example that I'm really proud of.
Yeah.
But there are also so many others, right? I mean, the Beatles would not have been the Beatles if John Lennon and Paul McCartney didn't combine forces, right?
This is it. Yeah. And they're all hiding in plain sight. And this is what I find quite ironic about so much of this. You can look anywhere and find these incredible collaborations, and they all share usually the same set of traits. And it's not surprising the traits you've talked about for Success Factor are the ones they are. In partnership, they actually are very similar.
That's right.
The question is, how quickly can you level up to see what the other party is bringing for that? It's really quite something.
That's right. And sometimes they make you better.
Right.
I mean, think of Bill Gates and Steve Jobs. The reason Microsoft and Apple are so successful is because they kept trying to one-up each other.
Mm-hmm.
If they didn't do that, neither one would have been as good.
That's true. And there is this paradox to hold as well. So yesterday in my newsletter, we talked about the idea that back in the mid-90s, Microsoft invested in Apple. To help restabilize the business. And of course, we forget the times in the 90s of what happened with Apple and all the tumultuousness that went on. But for Microsoft to put in $150 million US to restabilize the balance sheet of that company, to find a way, and people say, what did they do that for? Well, it was a pretty simple exchange in hindsight, but at the time, I'm sure it was quite tricky. It was, well, we'll put Internet Explorer onto Macs and we'll work on the Mac equivalent of Office to arrive there. That's what the quid pro quo for the $150 million was.
Yeah.
And people go, what was going on here? Aren't they cutthroat rivals? But often what sits behind that kind of adversarial piece is what people aren't paying attention to, which is this idea that actually they're probably more likely to be partners than anything else.
That's right. That's right.
So if you Absolutely. Are if you are in competitive tension with another organization, in fact, another human being, just take another look, because that what you're looking at could actually be a partner hiding in plain sight.
That's right. Well said.
Ruth, I have a set of rapid-fire questions for you in a second. But before we get to that, what is your cautionary tale for people about partnership?
You know, Oprah Winfrey once said, if anyone who you think is your friend is showing even a slightest bit of jealousy, you need to cut them off. And I thought, I mean, I love Oprah, but that's crazy. Why would your friends be jealous? As always, the Queen Oprah was right.
Right. Listen to Oprah.
Listen to Oprah.
Yep.
Absolutely. That's my cautionary tale without giving details.
Yeah, got it. I get it. All right, let's get into this rapid fire. And Ruth, thank you so much for making the time here to talk about this. I think that the factors that you've unearthed through your research, I'm hoping that people that listen to this do two things. One, they get to your book and resources so they can dive into this further. But more so, they look at these aspects that are very accessible. All you have to do is think carefully about what they could be and what the combination of those factors could be in your individual life. And I think you'll find not only will that aspect of the world be better, your own life, but the ability to partner is going to go up as well.
That's right.
So I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure.
All right. Rapid fire. Are you ready to go?
Okay. Buckle up.
All right. Here it is. Five questions.
All right.
Complete this sentence. Partnership is...
a collaboration where the final product is better than what each one of you can do alone.
What content are you loving at the moment? And by the way, this can be anything.
I am looking a lot at marketing in different ways.
Interesting. Is anything catching your attention right now?
I'm listening to a lot of podcasts right now. I have a long commute, so I
helpful.
That's my learning time.
My personal learning time. Well, look, for the sake of it, Seth Godin's most recent book, This Is Strategy, is fabulous.
Read it.
And he did not tell me to say that. All right. Number three, what is the worst piece of advice you've received and why?
So I mentioned I was 43 when I went back to school. And I told a mentor I want to do this. And he said to me, you don't need to do that for what you want to do. Except the problem was he never asked me what I want to do. So I didn't listen to him. I went back to school. I got my doctorate and my life changed for the better.
There's a big lesson in that. All right. when you see potential for a new partnership, what's the first thing you do to turn that potential into action?
Well, first I want to know how this is going to be better than the two of us doing it alone. And then we try a small pilot project first. I'm not working on a book until we work on an article first.
Yeah, clever. And finally, what's one thing you're truly grateful for right now?
I am grateful for family and health. Good health.
Excellent. Ruth Gottian, thank you so much for today. Before we go, where are we sending people for these great resources and for your other publications?
Absolutely. So if you go to my website, Ruth Gottian, G-O-T-I-A-N, ruthgottian.com, you'll find a ton there, including the resources we talked about. And if you follow me on LinkedIn, you will see a lot of it there as well.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. And I'm looking forward to our next conversation.
Likewise.
Thanks for listening to the end of this episode of Partnership Plus. If you like what you heard, you can share this episode via text message. And if you'd like to build your business partnership muscle, my free weekly newsletter called Wednesday Partnership will help you do just that. You'll find a link in the show notes. Finally, I'm big on encouragement and love to see people be in motion towards their ambitions. So if you know someone who might be struggling, reach out to them with a quick message of encouragement. It could change their life. Thanks again, and I'll see you in the next episode.